This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
I'll be talking about the history of the museum's Indigenous collections before they came to the museum. In fact, there had been ethnographic collections destined for a national museum in Australia for well over half a century before the NMA came into existence in 1980. I'll be using a few acronyms that are pretty well established now, like NMA and AIA for the Institute of Anatomy. When I started working with these collections in 1979, they were generally referred to as the National Ethnographic Collection, and I'll use the acronym NEC from now on, or far less frequently, the Commonwealth Ethnographic Collection. It was housed in the basement of the Australian Institute of Anatomy building, which now comprises the core of the National Film and Sound Archive building. The NEC was derived from four sources. The AIA, collections acquired by the Commonwealth and destined for a national museum. These collections were acquired between the 1920s, we don't actually have acquisition dates for the earliest collections, and the 1970s. First by Sir Colin McKenzie, and the AIA continued to receive collections after his retirement in 1937. Second one's the University of Sydney. In 1956, the University of Sydney took the decision to send its collections to the AIA on permanent loan, and they arrived at the Institute in February 1957. The Australian National University, its collections were stored at the AIA from the 1950s and were returned in the 90s. And the final group, the Australian Institute of Aboriginal Studies, now known as IATSIS. At first, until about 1966, the AIAS collections were stored at its premises in Braddon, but as space became short, their collections were moved to the AIA, and collections acquired subsequently were also housed there. All four groups included both Australian and Pacific material. With a total number of approximately 20,000 organic items, there was a roughly 60-40 split in favour of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander collections. I'll really just be referring to them as Aboriginal collections because there's virtually no Torres Strait material in the collections at that time. In addition, there are 80,000 odd Australian stone implements which comprise the bulk of the stone tools held by the museum today. With only one or two exceptions, they were all surface collected. This part of the collection is fairly represented geographically and in terms of tool types, and it's likely any further acquisitions will be limited and restricted to filling in so-called gaps. As the museum is not a designated repository, material from excavations is not deposited here. The museum did not acquire all of the collections that were at the AIA. In the early 1980s, the department responsible for the museum at the time, Home Affairs, sought to establish the ownership of the various components of the NEC. As a result, some parts of the collection were returned to the organisations from which they'd been received. What this meant was that the museum only took possession of those collections that were to become part of the National Historical Collection. This included both Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander and Pacific collections. The former were moved to the Mitchell Repository in 1987, when the building was only a year or two old. Those specific collections that the museum retained were moved to this Mitchell storage facility 2 years later. While the University of Sydney Aboriginal collections were amongst those moved to the repository in 1987, formal title to them was not transferred until 1989. The university transferred its specific collections to the Australian Museum in Sydney, and all of the ANU collections were returned to ANU. As far as the Pacific collections retained by the NMA are concerned, and I'm only going to speak briefly about the Pacific collections, they comprise a mix of Pacific-only collections, so collections with only Pacific material in them, and components of other collections where the collector collected other things, predominantly Aboriginal artefacts. Looking now at the collections that were transferred to the NMA, there were in the order of 280 collections. These comprised around, these are approximate figures by the way, 150 individual and 25 institutional collectors. The reason for this apparent discrepancy is that some collectors are represented by multiple collections. Just over 70% of the collections comprise organic artefacts only, and a further quarter are collections of stone implements. The remainder, a little under 4%, comprise both organic and stone items. A few collections, mainly from the latter group, also include Pacific items, and there are only a handful of collections that only comprise Pacific material. Amongst these are two significant collections made in New Guinea, and Sylvia over here will talk next about the most significant of these, the official Papuan or Sir Hubert Murray collection. The remaining Pacific collections were mainly derived from amateur collectors and in one sense form a very eclectic group of artefacts. While there is little geographic cohesiveness, there is a bias towards Papua New Guinea and the Solomon Islands. My impression of this part of the collection is that there is a broader range of object types than for the Aboriginal collections, but this is something I have yet to test. Something else I need to further investigate is my suspicion that the majority of the Pacific artefacts were acquired as part of the secondary artefact market. That is, the collectors did not acquire them from the producing communities, but from dealers, other collectors, and so on. Looking for a moment at the Institute, the AIA building, that is, itself, there were two galleries for exhibitions. The extensions running perpendicular to the axis of the entry and the offices part of the building. And it would have been very helpful to have the photograph to show you what that meant. Originally, these both had anatomical displays. As I understand it, one gallery was changed to display ethnographic material, both Aboriginal and Pacific, in the early 1960s. Also, as I understand it, these displays were started by Elizabeth Nidell, but the bulk of the development work was done by Helen Groger-Wurm, an Austrian-born and trained anthropologist. However, some Pacific material went on display as early as 1954. Once the exhibitions were installed, there was not a lot of change to them before the AIA closed its doors in 1984. In the 2 or 3 years prior to its closing, we changed parts of the case dealing with ceremonial matters to remove inappropriate photographs and changed one of the three cases dealing with bark paintings to one on rock art. The exhibitions were on the ground level. The basements below them were used for storage. The collections were mostly stored on movable trolleys made on site, apart from the stone implements, which were in two rooms on their own, largely stored on metal shelving or in the packing crates or cardboard boxes in which they arrived. Early in the 1980s, I moved the Pacific collections from their room in the basement where the Aboriginal collections were stored to the opposite basement and created a locked room for secret sacred objects, which until then had been stored in bundles in plastic bags along with other objects. This is a good place to make a brief reference to the curation of the collections while at the AIA. Now, I'm not pointing fingers here, but these comments are largely restricted to the AIA and University of Sydney collections. They effectively do not apply to the AIAS collections and do not extend to the NMA collection at all. The collections that the museum has acquired independently of these other components. A result of sometimes poor curation at the AIA is the disassociation of documentation with objects, resulting in several thousand now not having any collector information at all. I've been able to place many back into their collections. So, for example, the Bazzardo collection went from just over 100 items in the early 1980s to 1,100 or so in 1985, and in some cases remove objects incorrectly placed in various collections. This is a factor that always has to be taken into account when studying the relevant collections, not to mention the collections management problems this has created. Now, going back to the collections, all four components comprise a mix of collections made by professional and amateur collectors. This is a good time to pause and present you with some definitions to clarify some of the terms I'm going to use and have used. When I refer to professional collectors, I've used the dictionary, Oxford Dictionary I have at home, which defines professional as of belonging to, connected with a profession, with profession being a vocation or calling, especially one that involves some branch of advanced learning or science, in this case, ethnography/anthropology. The belonging to or connected with part of the definition is important because the nature of anthropology changed over time with the increasing professionalism of the discipline. Thus, I regard Herbert Basildo, who was practising prior to the founding of the first chair of anthropology in Australia in 1926, as a professional because he had a postgraduate degree in anthropology awarded in 1910 and because he published widely on Aboriginal cultures between 1904 and 1935. Later collectors are easy to slot in here because they held or hold paid positions in the discipline. Now, turning to amateur, the definition I'm using is one who practices a thing, especially an art or game, only as a pastime. The NEC had many amateur collectors represented, and they were collecting from the late 19th century right up to the 1970s. While some may have written about Indigenous cultures, their collecting and other related activities were undertaken in addition to their employment, i.e. as a hobby. Just the two other definitions I'll explain concern the nature of collecting, primary and secondary collecting. Primary is the first collector, either directly from Indigenous people, or in the case of stone implements, from a site, and usually from the surface of the ground in the case of the NEC collections. Secondary refers to objects acquired from people other than Indigenous people, i.e. other collectors, dealers, second-hand shops, etc. I also use the term compound until I can think of something better to describe those collectors who were a mix of both secondary and primary collectors. And quite often those people, particularly the amateurs anyway, collected the organic material as secondary collectors but might have collected the stone tools as primary collectors. And of course that's not a hard and fast rule, but it is a majority who fall into that category. The processes these definitions relate to are important in understanding how the makeup of the NEC came about. For example, some of its more notable characteristics include biases towards Central and Northern Australia and a high percentage of men's weapons and tools, ceremonial objects and paintings. The former, so the bias, the geographical bias, I think, can largely be explained by notions of Aboriginality that were in force when our earlier collectors were active and ties in with the relative lateness of the collections in the NEC when compared to many of the state collections. The earliest collections were not started until the late 19th century and the majority after this. So by the time most of the early collectors were active, the prevailing perception seems to have been that real Aboriginal people were those of unmixed descent whose lifestyle was more or less unaffected or little affected by white culture. So we're talking about people living in Central and Northern Australia, effectively. This concept of the real was a genuine issue for collectors. In terms of collecting artefacts, two NEC collectors expressed, 40 years apart, their concern for being able to collect what they called genuine artefacts. About 1915, Edmund Milne, in his unpublished notes on the Australian Aborigines, wrote, and I quote, "The shrinkage of the southeastern Australian clans has been painfully, appallingly rapid, and has been accompanied by an equally surprising disappearance of genuine tribal relics, this hampering the student of today in a marked degree." In an interview in 1961, Bob Wishart expressed similar views, stating that genuine wooden artefacts were those made with stone implements, and he actively sought out what he perceived artefacts to have been made in the old ways by stone artefacts and those that were used by people rather than made for sale. Understanding the bias towards men's weapons and tools in these collections is harder to interpret and requires explanations beyond the often given reason that most collectors were men, but this isn't something I'll have time to go into here. So before looking at how some of our collectors made their collections, I want to look briefly at the nature of collections made by professional and amateur collectors. Taking this into account, what can we see in the collections made by professionals and by amateurs? While all collections are eclectic, there are characteristics of the two groups that exhibit consistency overall. So what I'm about to present is not a hard and fast rule. There aren't, all amateurs did this and all professionals did this. But broadly speaking, geographical distribution, professional collectors collected in restricted geographical areas, whereas amateur collectors, well, their collections are fairly unrestricted, and some collectors have artefacts from all over the country. Many amateur collectors also may include non-Australian components, and they may even have collected more broadly biological, geological, non-Indigenous objects, and I'm aware that, of course, that some professional collectors did that in the early days as well. In terms of the range of objects, professional collectors tend to have a broader range of objects or a better representation of objects. Some amateur collectors have a fairly broad range of objects, but the emphasis always tends to be on, frequently tends to be on weapons and tools, and then less emphasis on, say, women's objects, ornaments and so on. And in terms of documentation, usually the professional collectors have a higher level of documentation. And that's a relative thing too. People recorded a lot less information in, the early 20th century as opposed to, say, the late 20th century. So I think people's requirements for the information that they wanted were different, and this, of course, hampers us in the 21st century when we want to use some of the earlier collections. There are other differences between professional and amateur collectors. The most obvious is that professional collectors collect as part of their work and they publish aspects of their work. Although, especially depending on what period we're looking at, not necessarily on material culture. For example, many of the anthropologists who undertook fieldwork at the University of Sydney in the 1920s and 30s were represented in the NEC, and while most were not particularly interested in material culture, they were expected to make material culture collections, as Jeff explained earlier. They were issued with written fieldwork instructions, including advice on making and documenting material culture collections. Actually, I'll leave that out because Jeff went through that. Amateur collectors obviously spent time on their hobby outside of their work commitments and rarely published anything relating to Indigenous cultures, let alone material culture. Three notable NEC exceptions in this regard are Stan Mitchell, who published on stone implements, including a book, Catherine Langlo Parker, who published an ethnography of the Yuyalaroi people of north central New South Wales with valuable information on material culture, as well as several works on mythology, and George Horn, who co-authored with George Aston in 1924 another ethnography titled Savage Life in Central Australia, which was an ethnography of the Lake Eyre groups, or on the eastern side anyway. Horn also published on stone implements too. There were elements in common between our professional and amateur collectors as well. The most obvious is their shared interest in Indigenous cultures. Many were members of societies, sometimes together. For example, Roy Goddard, an amateur of Sydney, was a member of the Anthropological Society of New South Wales. In fact, he was a founding member. Early membership of this society was dominated by amateurs, and this remained the case until the discipline of anthropology became more prominent, after which the societies became more the domain of professionals. In Sydney, for example, if you take a look at the office bearers listed in the early issues of that society's journal, Mankind, you can see a gradual takeover, in inverted commas, by the professionals. From the local university, names like A.P. Elkin are amongst the earliest to appear. It's interesting, I was talking to Roy Goddard's son a few years ago, and apparently this was quite an issue for Roy because he felt like he was being pushed out once the professional anthropologist started to move into the society. A number of professional collectors represented in the NEC were students at the University of Sydney and made their collections I'll just move on to some of the collectors. Naturally, we know more about some more than others. Probably Australia's first professional anthropologist is represented, Herbert Bazzardo. He studied in Germany before 1910, but before going there and afterwards undertook numerous field trips. And it was on these trips that he would have acquired most of his collection. These were in central and northern Australia, so much more broad ranging than other professional anthropologists. And now moving on to the University of Sydney, the collectors, it reads like a who of early professional anthropology in this country. We're looking at people like Lloyd Warner in the Milngimby area, Ursula McConnell in Cape York, Stanner and Daly River, Charles Hart on Melbourne Bathurst Islands, Elkin in the Kimberley, the Musgrave Ranges, Burnt in Arnhem Land, Gerhard Larvis in the Kimberley and Daly River, and Piddington and Phyllis Cabry in the Kimberley, and later on Mervyn Meggett with the Walpri in Central Australia. The University of Sydney collections include some notable amateur collectors too, acquired during Elkin's time as head of department. Prominent amongst these are two who published accounts of their experiences or knowledge. So we've heard about Catherine Langlois Parker. Another was Jesse Hammond in southern Western Australia. I'll leave that. So, if the amateurs collected as hobbies, what were their professions? There were medical doctors like Crowther, George Horn, Bob Wishart, an accountant, Roy Goddard, a railways deputy commissioner, Edmund Milne, other government employees, the metallurgist, Stan Mitchell, pastoralist, J.W. Lindo, Catherine Langlois Parker, F.G. Goddard, George Murray Black, missionaries like Alf Dyer, mission employees Bruce Coldrake, and dealers like Dorothy Bennett and Jim Davidson, a patrol officer, Lou Parlett, and a filmmaker, Ian Dunlop. There are also Aboriginal arts organisations represented from Yirrkala and Maningrida, as well as an overseas museum that returned Australian artefacts back in 1968, the Salisbury and Wiltshire Museum in England. And there's also that joint American-Australian scientific expedition to Arnhem Land in 1948. There are many others who I know little or nothing about. It's relatively easy to find out information about professional collectors, but this is not always the case with amateurs. Most collectors represented in the NHC are long dead, which doesn't help. I've spoken to descendants, many now quite elderly, who have been very helpful. As well as the professional collectors out of Sydney University, other anthropologists are also represented. Probably the most significant of these was made by Helen Groger Verm on Mornington Island in 1960 and in Arnhem Land each year between 1965 and 1970. Other notable later anthropologists include Howard Morphy, who's here, Brian Hayden, Nancy Munn and Carol Cooker. Morphy and Cooker both collected art, and Howard in particular have published in this area. Hayden undertook ethno-archaeological work in Central Australia in 1969, studying stone tools with some of the last people with detailed knowledge of their manufacture and use. The stone implements used in the project and figured in his book net formed part of the NEC. I've only provided glimpses of some of the many collectors represented in the NEC. What we currently know about some are mere snippets, while the lives and collecting of others are known in more detail. Excuse me. Some have been researched by museum staff, while others have written their own stories. But many more remain to be discovered, and this kind of research is often difficult and time-consuming. We can and should talk to those collectors who are still alive, but time is running out, and we need to act quickly if we are to talk to we really need to talk to the descendants of the collectors who are deceased now, because a lot of them are elderly. Some of the people I've been dealing with are in their 80s. And if we don't do this work now, the people who had that direct link with those collectors will be gone, and we just won't have that information. Anyway, thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.